Time again for Midday on the Bay, our monthly look at news and issues related to the vast Chesapeake watershed. Today, urban environmentalism and the forgotten Baltimore. How green space can improve your mood, reduce heat, and even reduce trash in city neighborhoods. Also, a look at how poor planning in Baltimore, the infamous highways to nowhere, took a community backwards. Rona Cabell of the Chesapeake Bay Journal joins us again, along with, for the first time, Maryland's new Environment Secretary, Ben Grumbles. We'll hear his vision for protecting the land and waters of the Chesapeake region. Midday on the Bay, with Rona Cabell, coming up after the news from NPR. Welcome back, everyone. Dan Rodericks here. Time again for Midday on the Bay, our monthly look at news and issues related to the vast Chesapeake watershed. That we do this show in collaboration with the Chesapeake Bay Journal and its ace reporter, Rona Cabell. Rona, nice to see you again.
Thank you. Nice to see you, too.
All right. Prepare to blush now. The National Audubon Society honored Bay Journal staff writer Rona Cabell yesterday at its 12th annual lunch Women in Conservation Luncheon at the Plaza Hotel in New York City. Rona Cabell was among 26 women greening journalism who received special recognition for their work to advance public awareness of environmental issues. Very nice. Congratulations. Well-deserved, Rona Cabell.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. What'd you have for lunch?
Oh, they made vegetarian food for us.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
So we had like a vegetarian pasta with peas and arugula and a salad, and then for dessert, some very dainty, lovely ice cream kind of thing that was delicious.
This is a great recognition. Women greening journalism, meaning advancing our understanding of environmental issues. And there's a lot of women doing writing like as you are, right?
Yes.
Writing in this field.
It was exciting for me because, I mean, around here, people do know the Bay Journal, but nationally, I wasn't sure how much people read it. So it was really thrilling to be among all these national journalists from the Huffington Post and Popular Science and The Guardian and
New York Times.
And the New York Times. And we were included in that. And it was pretty special. Thank you.
Well,
very
you're
much.
Special. You do great work. We're lucky to have you here on Midday as well, Rona. And we got a number of things we want to talk about today. But you sent me the headline, Urban Environmentalism and the Forgotten Baltimore. What do you mean the Forgotten Baltimore in this regard?
Well, I think when we talk about greening cities and making cities more livable, we talk about the harbor and in Philadelphia, we talk about the waterfront there. In Chicago, we talk about Grant Park. And we forget about these pockets of poverty in Baltimore that deserve green space just as much as everybody else and contribute to the pollution just as much as everybody else when they don't have it. And I just wanted to talk about some efforts that have been made lately to green these places and what more can be done. And also just to remind people that there are so many opportunities here to turn these vacant properties and asphalt areas into green spaces and how this can not only improve the flow of stormwater and sewage and other things, but also improve our mood, improve our well-being, lower our crime rate, all sorts of other benefits.
You know, a while ago, I wrote in a column in The Sun, this is some years ago now, that with all these vacant houses, I realized we have to preserve a lot of them. There's an effort to preserve them, resell them in the hope that population will grow and people will want to use those houses again, live in them again. But Baltimore is a sprawling city, east and west, big spaces out there that where, you know, there's this abandonment for decades now. And I thought, is it a given that people want to live in row houses within the city limits? Can't you build smaller detached homes or, I don't know, Rogers Forge type of attached homes with more green space? Can't you just open up and build more parkland in some of those areas? We don't see too much of that. We do see some urban gardening going on.
Right.
But there are places such as McElderry Park, for instance. Now, that's an interesting area. McElderry Park, but there's really no park there, right?
Right. There's no park.
It's in East Baltimore.
It's in East Baltimore, and there's no park in McElderry Park. It's kind of a nice neighborhood anchored by, I mean, it's a low-income neighborhood, but it's actually quite a lovely neighborhood, and it's anchored by a couple churches. And the National Wildlife Federation, a year or so ago, decided to make a big investment in McElderry Park, a $200,000-plus investment. And they partnered with a bunch of groups, including MICA students and the Baltimore Tree Trust and neighborhood groups, and they all got together and basically engineered a solution to green alleys and backyards. And rather than just coming in and sort of imposing a solution on McElderry Park, they're giving vouchers to homeowners and renters to choose their own way to green their backyards and planting trees. And there were a lot of obstacles, Dan, towards planting trees in Baltimore. You had to get permission from a homeowner to plant a tree. So if you have a rental unit and the homeowner lives in Florida and you keep sending them certified letters and they don't respond and years go by and you don't get your tree. So they changed the law in the city to say that you didn't need permission. You could plant the trees on the street. And it's helped immensely. People are really buying into it there. And with such a big investment in such a small community, I think you can really see a difference.
You wrote a story about this a few months ago about McElderry Park.
I did, for the
Bay Journal. So how do people receive that intervention? I mean, is it well received, in other words? And do people cooperate? Do they have time to even think about the greening of their neighborhood?
I think it's well received in the way that they're doing it in this way because they have all these groups on board partnering. I think in the past, it hasn't always been well received when some outside sort of do-gooder type group comes in and says, oh, we're going to build you a garden, or, oh, we're going to, you know, do this for you. And then sometimes it's not well maintained. And in the case of McElderry Park, somebody came in years ago, I think a Habitat for Humanity, and very well intentioned, but decided to build a vegetable garden with raised beds. And really nobody was taking care of it. And it became a haven for rats. And it turned out that that wasn't really what they wanted. They didn't really want a vegetable garden. What they wanted were rain gardens and these sort of swales to take up the water so that it wouldn't flood. Hmm. And that's what...
Had anyone taken the time to ask people in the neighborhood what they wanted?
Well, I'm not sure because this was, you know, years ago. But I think Habitat for Humanity, you know, they built a bunch of houses in the neighborhood and they thought, oh, this will be a great thing. We'll do a garden. But, you know, as I have learned at my own home, if you don't maintain these things, they tend to just become weed infested. And you really need to appoint somebody to be in charge of it. And you need the people who live in the neighborhood to really want that.
Right. What are city garden land trusts?
Oh, this was an interesting story I did a couple years ago. There are about 8 spaces in the city that have become permanently protected as land trusts. What basically happened is over the years, enterprising neighbors got together and would take control or ownership over a lot, and they'd make it a park or they'd plant vegetables. And one of the best examples of it is the Duncan Street Miracle Garden on North Collington Street, which is 44 lots. They used to be alley houses and they were all torn down. And there's this beautiful garden there. And the vegetables that are grown in the garden feed the people in the community. They go to the churches and they also sustain the people who grow the gardens. But the Duncan Street Miracle Garden was not permanently protected. And anytime the city wanted to, it could sell that land to a developer and that could be gone.
What is its status today?
So it's protected under this Baltimore land trust that Miriam Avon started. She started it when she was at the Open Society Institute, and she's continued it into its own thing. And basically, she protects these properties. She'll hold her organization will hold the deed so that they're protected under easements, just like, you know, land at the Blackwater National Wildlife Refuge is, or just like the Masonville Cove Project is. So they're permanently protected under an easement as long as you continue to do what the work that's being done. So, you know, should you want to build a condo, it wouldn't be allowed.
Take a minute and describe what that looks like. The Duncan Street Miracle Garden, which is actually on North Carlington. This is on the east side too.
Oh, it's beautiful. It's kind of near Greenmount, and it's just lovely. I mean, when I was there a couple summers ago, they were growing you know, spinach and kale. And we were getting recipes from the guys who grew the food about, you know, how they make the kale and what they do with it. Because I am challenged myself how to make kale tasty. And they were saying, oh, well, you should bake it and you should do this and put this sauce on it and make it with eggs. And
you know, I just wanted to say that's an area that I know for drug dealing and years ago, some homicides.
Yes. So, well, it was. I mean, that's why they basically tore the neighborhood down, because it was becoming a haven for drug dealers and blight. And these alley houses are so small that you were able to get, I mean, that's a lot of 44 lots is a lot of of space. And when you're in this garden, it's pretty large. I mean, you can see on either side, you can see row houses. There's also some Vietnamese immigrants that come to the garden in 10 plots, and they eat the vegetables just like they did in their home countries. So, I mean, I think not all the Baltimore green space is as ambitious as the Miracle Garden. There's a chess park. They've preserved the horseshoe pit in Pigtown.
Wait a minute. There's a Pigtown horseshoe pit?
There's a Pigtown horseshoe pit. And Pigtown is...
I didn't know that.
Pigtown, as you know, is, you know, they've renamed it Washington Village, and they've tried to
Some people have.
Some people have. It's still Pigtown to me.
Yeah.
But I used to live next to it in South Baltimore, and, you know, that's an area that's in... I'm going to say in danger, in the crosshairs of developers. I mean, that's an area that they've always sort of envisioned more housing there. And so this horseshoe pit could have become built up, but it's been preserved. And, you know, that's an important part of our history, that these areas were once, you know, part of Baltimore's sort of meat growing culture, which we did have here, a meat packing culture. And the pigs used to run through Pigtown. That's how it's got its name. So these are important sort of pockets of our culture that they're preserving.
You know, I got kind of excited. If I had more time to volunteer for one more thing, it would be the Mill Corridor Project, where, you know, folks are trying to clean up this beautiful, the Jones Falls, parts of it that are beautiful, that run through the center of the city, downtown. But parts of it are paved over, or were paved and turned into a large gully for flood control years ago. And some parts you don't even see. But the Mill Corridor, the parts you do see, I mean, is exciting potential there for trails and hiking and biking. But you wanted to talk a little bit about the paved over watersheds of the city.
Yes. So in Sandtown, Winchester is above this watershed called Watershed 263. Watershed 263 is 43 miles of paved over watershed. And so what happens in Watershed 263 and in Sandtown, Winchester is that's a neighborhood with a lot of asphalt. And when it rains, the water hits the streets and goes underground in these chutes and then goes right to the Gwynns Falls. And the Gwynns Falls is a real mess. I've been back there several times. It is just a fetid mess with garbage and sewage and stormwater. And it's extremely sad to see.
You're talking about the Gwynns Falls.
The Gwynns Falls,
right.
Yes. Because it's right next to Leakin Park, and it could be so beautiful if we would take better care of it. But it's difficult to do because they paved it over so long ago. And so that's Watershed 263. And then there's something called the Baltimore Direct Harbor Watershed Association, which is closer to the McElderry Park area. And that's also been just warren of storm drains and stormwater outfalls that have been paved over. And it just goes back to the time when our goal was to get the water away. We didn't really want to look at it. We didn't really want it to come into our homes. And so however we could channelize it and get it off our streets, that's what we were going to do. And
well, the idea of unchannelizing them or breaking open the pavement seems so expensive. So are other cities trying anything in that regard? Is this something we could do here?
Yeah. I mean, the thing that most cities are, the cities that are trying are doing something called green infrastructure, which is they're not so much trying to untangle the web of concrete, but they're trying to use what they can to lessen the load of stormwater. So Milwaukee's a really good example. They're doing a huge green infrastructure project where they're trying to take vacant lots and put on green roofs and make more parks. We had the Charlotte Katzenmoyer from Lancaster on our show a couple years ago here, and she's doing the same thing in Lancaster. Rather than spend $2 billion to untangle their their stormwater sewage web. They're focusing on green infrastructure. And in those two places, it's working very well. Philadelphia is trying it. And even in a big city, you can make major changes just by doing more green infrastructure. And,
and when you say green infrastructure, everybody, I think, understands you mean tree planting, obviously,
yes.
Number one. But what else?
Pocket parks, green roofs, areas like Pierce's Park at the Inner Harbor is a really good example. There is a park that was created basically to absorb rainfall, and it's become this wonderful amenity downtown. I mean, when I take my children downtown, they're as interested in going to Pierce Park as they are in going to the aquarium or the Science Center.
It's fun.
It's fun. It's just this little small amenity that's brought so much joy, I think, to the downtown area. So things like that. Obviously, you can't put a Pierce's Park in every place. But
that's what you mean by a pocket park.
Yeah. And also in Lancaster, one of the things they're doing is they're taking asphalt and repaving all the roads that need to be repaved with porous pavement. So it's not like they're creating additional expense. They're just spending the money that they would have spent anyway, but just doing it in a better way.
In a different way, so that it's not impervious.
It takes a lot of creative thinking at the level of public works director.
If you live in the city of Baltimore and know a place that desperately needs to be greened, let's talk about it. Give us a call, 410-662-8780, while Rona Cabell is here from the Chesapeake Bay Journal for this edition of Midday on the Bay. Coming up later in the show, we hope to meet Maryland's new Environment Secretary, Ben Grumbles. He's on his way here and should be joining us in the studio. If you have questions for him, you can send us an email in advance of him being here, midday at wypr.org. If you live in an area that has been a recipient of one of these greening programs over McElderry Park or Duncan Street, the Duncan Street Miracle,
a
reservoir, anywhere, we'd like to hear from you and get your thoughts about it. 410-662-8780. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Midday on the Bay. Dan Roderick's here with the award-winning reporter for the Chesapeake Bay Journal, Rona Cabell. Rona, there's one other thing I wanted to talk about, is parks in general. Some people are afraid of parks.
That's right.
Yeah,
they are.
They are. That's a thing.
Especially Leakin Park.
Yeah, it does have a reputation. It's kind of unfair. It's a beautiful place. And it's so vast, too.
It's beautiful. It's vast. And we shouldn't be afraid of it. In fact, I did a story for the Bay Journal, which hasn't run yet, but I wrote a story a few months ago for Slate about when the podcast Serial, which you've talked about a lot on your show, was on. Because I happen to know that people in this city were working really hard to change the reputation of Leakin Park, and I wanted to know what they thought about the fact that this show was kind of inadvertently bringing back the bodies to West Baltimore. And so I went out and I biked the trail with a city employee. It was very impromptu. I just met him at the park one day, and he offered to take me on a bike ride. And we went through the park, and it's a beautiful place. And when you're there, I mean, about 5 minutes in, you're right by the Raven Stadium is where the bike trail starts. So you're at the stadium, and you got I-95, and it's really noisy. And then in about 7 minutes, you're in the wilderness, and you could be in the Shenandoah Valley. I mean, that's how beautiful it is. It's just lovely, and you don't really see another person for miles.
410-662-8780 is our phone number here if you'd like to join our conversation as we talk with Rona Cabell about urban environmentalism and what could be done. You know, my idea of having more green space in those parts of East Baltimore, West Baltimore, that have been abandoned for so long, where you see even one block or two blocks. How do you get something like that started? I mean, who do you go to? Is there a grand czar in Baltimore for overseeing all that? I guess the housing department, if it involves vacant houses.
Well,
but what about after that?
Baltimore has a few cool programs. They have an Office of Sustainability, which they're pretty proactive from what I understand. They have the Vacants to Value program. They have something called Power in Dirt, which allows you to, if you have a vacant lot, it allows you to get a water source to it so that you could green. I think Blue Water Baltimore is doing a lot of this kind of work. Some of it I kind of feel like isn't well publicized, and maybe that's kind of our job as the Bay Journal and other journalists to let people know that this stuff is available.
Sean in Baltimore with a question. Thanks for calling Midday on the Bay. Go right ahead, Sean.
Hi, good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call.
Sean, you have to turn your radio down because we get, it doesn't work if you have your radio up.
Okay.
All right. Go right ahead with your question.
Yeah, I actually live really near Blue Water, Baltimore. I'm just an artist that moved here from New York. There's a wonderful sort of area that to me is a park space, or could be, and I'd like to make it like an art park and involve the children that's nearby with a school here. How does an individual without ties to an organization begin?
Where are you talking about, Sean? What part of town?
Baylor Edison, near the Brems Elementary School.
Near Herring Run Park, sounds like.
Yeah.
Near Erdman, Baylor Road, that area.
I would talk to Blue Water Baltimore. I mean, they're pretty proactive about this kind of stuff. And just give them a call or stop by their office.
Hey, Rona, you want to talk about highway projects. I mentioned the famous Highway to Nowhere. Well, we've got a couple of them, actually. Couple of highway systems here from the early 70s, mid-70s that led to disruptions of neighborhoods, the loss of lots of housing, especially on the west side, the Franklin Mulberry Corridor. That's where the Highway to Nowhere is.
Right. Well, this is a story that is very close to my heart because about 4 years ago, we had two women on this show, Inez Robb and Betty Bland Thomas.
I remember that, yeah.
Yeah, it was a great show.
Now, they were from Sharp-Leadenhall.
So Betty is from Sharp-Leadenhall, and Inez is from Sandtown, Winchester. And it happened to be that they both needed a ride to the show. And I knew I wanted them on because I had heard Inez. There was a conference downtown or in Harbor East at this swanky, I think at Leg Mason or someplace. And there were all these people talking about greening the harbor and swimmable, fishable by 2020. And Inez got up there from the audience and she said, "Don't forget about us. Don't forget about the neighborhoods. Don't forget about Sandtown, Winchester when you're doing all these things. Don't forget about Watershed 263. And I really admired her for standing up for her neighborhood. And so when I was driving them both home, we drove on the Highway to Nowhere, which is sort of this ditch of a road that goes, as you said, from Franklin and Mulberry all the way to where I guess US 40 starts.
About Edmondson Avenue.
Yes. Yeah, and I asked, "What is this?" And she said, "Oh, it's the Highway to Nowhere." And
you hadn't seen it before.
I had seen it, but it's different to see it when you're with someone who knows it. I mean, and she explained that what had happened was that in the 60s and 70s, Baltimore wanted to build a highway that connected an interstate that went through the city. And so they
out through Lincoln Park.
Right. Mm-hmm. And so they took this neighborhood, this middle class African American neighborhood, and they bisected it with this highway. And in the process, the people moved, the neighborhood became destabilized, and it became an eyesore. And then they never finished the highway because people protested building it in Lincoln Park.
That's what stopped it.
That's what stopped it.
The fight to keep it from going through Lincoln Park. So the federal highway system or the interstate highway division in Maryland just started building the thing.
Right.
And then stopped, and you end up with that big ditch that you have there now.
Right.
But isn't there a plan now to, if the red line comes through, the red line will go through there in part, but there's also a greening plan for it, isn't there?
Yeah, I mean, not much has
happened. Supposedly, not much has happened, but I supposedly there's a greening plan for it.
So then I drove Betty home, and we talked about the dollar houses, and I had always thought the dollar houses were this great savior of Baltimore, and she said, "Oh no, they bisected our neighborhood too, and thousands of African American residents were forced out, and Otterbein got fixed up, but." And so it just kind of made me realize that history of these projects is written by the people who won, not by the people who lost. And so you understand, you have a much better understanding of what happened in Baltimore and really this shameful legacy that other cities have, and we have too, of taking middle-class neighborhoods and ruining them with these highway projects.
Now, Sharp-Leadenhall, the second area you mentioned where Betty lived,
yes.
There were a lot of vacant lots there when I got to town in the 70s, or early 80s, and then they slowly started to build new housing in there. But you're right. I mean, wholesale blocks of houses were gone, and then they never built the highway.
Right.
They never built that part of it.
And Barbara Mikulski gets a lot of credit for stopping it over there.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the people in Harlem Park were not able to their focus was, okay, this thing's coming, let's get just compensation. But in truth, they didn't even get that.
It wasn't only African-American neighborhoods, too. In Canton, the highway was supposed to go through there, and lots of blocks were knocked down. There were vacant lots there in the 70s and 80s. And the Canton you see now is not the Canton that I first saw back then because of the threat of the highway coming in or the plan that was killed. Rona Cobell from the Chesapeake Bay Journal. We're going to take another little break here on Midday on the Bay. When we come back, Ben Grumbles will be meeting us for the first time, and we'll be meeting him for the first time. Maryland's new Secretary of the Environment will be in the studio. If you have questions for him, please feel free to join us. 410-662-8780. Welcome back to Midday and Midday on the Bay. Dan Roderick's here with Rona Cobell, the Chesapeake Bay Journal. And now Ben Grumbles, Maryland's new Environment Secretary, Secretary of the Department of Environment. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you, Dan.
Ben Grumbles comes to this job by appointment of Governor Larry Hogan. I think it was in March he appointed you. Before that, you were with the U.S. Water Alliance.
Right.
What is the U.S. Water Alliance?
It is a unique national organization that's devoted to establishing a national water policy to change the way America views, values, and manages water. And in particular, helping to foster a revolution in greening our cities and using natural systems, green infrastructure, and reusing water, recognizing that all water has value and that every drop counts.
So you're familiar with the topics we're discussing
in
this hour.
I am.
It's
exciting, too, because it's so important locally and nationally.
Where were you before that job? I know the answer to that. You worked at the Environmental Protection Agency, right?
I did. I also worked briefly out in Arizona as their Secretary of the Environment, Director of Environmental Quality. But I've been in the Chesapeake Bay area for 30 years, working on Capitol Hill, and then working as an official in the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency.
Here's a question that came in from Jana, one of our listeners. Our church, she says, which is located in the city, is considering a green roof. What can I say to the skeptics in terms of the impact of putting on a green roof on a city church? Rona, you want to take that? And then we'll hear from Ben, maybe.
I'll take that, yes. I think the first thing you can tell them is that this will reduce whatever bill they might have to pay for their stormwater. There are programs in Prince George's County and other counties, and Secretary Grumbles can probably talk more because he'll know the whole scope of Maryland, that will allow you to reduce your fee that you have to pay if you put in green infrastructure. And if I would put a green roof on my house, I couldn't really get much traction out of that. But a church, that's a huge roof. It will also reduce your air conditioning bills, reduce the heat island effect. There's a green roof at my daughter's school, and it's become this great amenity for picnics.
It's a flat roof, I guess.
It's a flat roof.
Wow.
I'm surprised anybody's skeptical about a green roof. I see no downside.
Well, maybe the cost of it makes people in a church skeptical.
I just have one more thing to say. I was at a conference in St. Louis last week, and they showed a photograph of Chicago, the city building and the county building next to each other. I don't know if you've seen this picture. It's quite dramatic, where the city building has a green roof and the county building does not. And they compared the energy bills for both buildings. And it's astounding what a difference it makes.
Yeah, I would say this, Dan. Local projects, they have to pencil out. They can't be so expensive that it's a barrier to implement them. But the U.S. Water Alliance had experts from around the country. We issued a national report on barriers and gateways to green infrastructure. It's a growing field of practice. It's very exciting when we start reawakening to the urban canopy. As Rona pointed out, if you look at the types of benefits, from energy savings to reduced fees from stormwater to the urban heat island effect, utilities, wastewater utilities, stormwater utilities, local leaders are increasingly getting on the bandwagon. But it always depends on what you plant, how you maintain that green roof. You know, the details matter. but it can be a beautiful thing. And the skeptics are going to learn over time that this country is turning to natural systems to manage their water and have environmental and community benefits.
Just a question from me, a point of information on stormwater remediation in Maryland. Where did we end up with churches and nonprofits in that whole picture of cities and county, the city of Baltimore and the counties charging fees to nonprofits?
Well, they
and churches
can get special treatment. They can be exempt. There are different conditions and demonstrations that have to be made, but there are special provisions that recognize that non-governmental entities like churches, nonprofit organizations are not put in the same category as other.
But they
systems.
Are charged something, or they don't get a full exemption.
They don't get a full exemption.
Right. Okay. And I know that some churches have already grabbed this thing and gone with it, creating rain gardens. I don't know about roofs, but maybe
yes.
You are familiar with one, Rona.
Yeah, a lot of them have. Towson Presbyterian has done a lot of stuff around its community. Brown Memorial is creating this natural playground. I happen to just know these two because I frequent both of those properties. But many are. And, you know, a lot of churches are connecting the message of godliness and environmental stewardship to the stormwater fee and saying, you know, we are stewards of this planet. There's a religious overtone to it, and we need to protect what we've got. And I think particularly in Prince George's County, it is a message that has really resonated. And we've done a lot of stories at the Journal about the particular programs there. So I think nobody ever wants to pay more for anything, especially when you don't have to. But I think there's this understanding now that it's all of our problem, the pollution, and we need to work on it together to solve it.
Secretary Grumbles, you know, the stormwater remediation fee plan has been altered in the General Assembly this past session. It was widely ridiculed as a rain tax by Governor Hogan and others. But anyway, it's in place. It's just not mandated as it was before. But the counties and the city are still subject to the requirements of the Environmental Protection Agency. Right. And I don't think a lot of people, most people still are convinced that this is the largest growing source of pollution we have in the Bay. People still see it as rain. Maybe you want to address that.
Yeah. So personally, I'm feeling appreciative as to how the legislative debate played out. Never at one point during the debate were people questioning the importance of preventing stormwater pollution.
So I'm wrong then. So
no,
is it a minority of people who think this is rain?
No, I think the legislators, the governor, all of the thought leaders that are focused on protecting the environment and ensuring economic development and healthy communities continue to prosper recognize that controlling stormwater pollution is and has to be a priority. The TMDL, the pollution budget for the Chesapeake Bay, basically if you look at what's required in that important roadmap for progress, $5.9 billion is the estimated cost for the stormwater pollution permits just for the larger jurisdictions that have stormwater pollution prevention plans. And so from my perspective, it's important for there to be both flexibility and accountability. And on the flexibility piece, the legislature agreed, okay, counties, we're going to continue to say you have the flexibility now as to how you determine how to pay. There has to be locally dedicated funding for these important environmental projects. But there also has to be increased accountability, and that's where the Maryland Department of the Environment will be involved. The legislature said there needs to be a reporting process every 2 years. We're basically going to be like accountants. And for us, we've absolutely got to provide the flexibility so that local leaders, whether it's Adam Ortiz in Prince George's County managing the stormwater program or Lisa Felt in Montgomery County or the leaders in Baltimore County or Baltimore City, they need flexibility to design these stormwater programs and projects and fund them. But
is there going to be a clock running? I understand
flexibility.
There is a clock.
There is a clock running. There's a clock running, and there are enforcement teams at both Maryland Department of the Environment, but also the U.S. EPA. And that's an important part of the whole progress towards the Chesapeake Bay.
I think Dan's right, though. I think that people do regard stormwater differently than sewage. I think people don't understand that it's more than just rain.
Right.
And as somebody who communicates these issues regularly, I have found it difficult to convince people like my neighbors and, you know, other people online who I encounter why this is important. And, you know, with sewage, you don't have to convince them. People intrinsically know that it's bad if sewage gets in your rivers. They don't want that. They're willing to do whatever they can to prevent it, which is one reason why the flush fee or flush tax was nearly universally welcomed. The only people who weren't crazy about it were the septic users, and that was because they weren't on the sewage systems to begin with. But I do think it's difficult to convey. And because Baltimore doesn't have, we have a few places where our systems are connected, but we don't really have a combined sewage system like they have in other cities. And so we don't have the message that we're trying to uncouple things. We just have the message that we're trying to get the stormwater out of the rivers because it's going in untreated. And I think that is just, I mean, we saw it with the debate over the fee in the first place,
mm-hmm.
that, you know, many people thought it was a rain tax and didn't want to pay it.
Is there any money for public education on this? Because I don't think people see in their own lives their contribution to it.
No, there is. There is. There are different organizations that are committed to helping Marylanders and citizens change the way they view water, and that includes rainwater, stormwater. I agree with Rona that the fundamental opportunity for us all in Maryland, where we are environmental leaders as citizens, when you look around the country, the basic challenge is that over the years, the success of the Federal Clean Water Act has focused on sewage and industrial waste coming out of a pipe. When it starts as rain, hits the ground, is runoff, whether it's from a construction site or an agricultural field, it is viewed differently. But the basic point is that it increasingly is a major stressor, a challenge to the health of our local streams and waterways and our beloved Chesapeake Bay. So it does take time, and it requires some new skills, new tools to use to better manage. My favorite saying that someone once said was that the history of the land is written in the water. And that sums up the fact that our most successful approach to water pollution control is land use. But that can't be done by a federal agency successfully, or even by a state agency, or by a legislator in Annapolis. It requires local leadership and buy-in, and most importantly, citizen awareness and understanding as to what it is and how it can be a problem, as well as a solution.
Maryland Environmental Secretary Ben Grumbles is our guest here on Midday. 410-662-8780 is our phone number if you have a question for him. Rona Cabell, I'd love to hear what kind of questions you want to ask Secretary Grumbles while he's here for the next 10 minutes or so. So go right ahead.
Well, I wanted to talk a little bit about lead.
Lead
poisoning. Last month, we had a guest, Michael Hawthorne of the Chicago Tribune, and he was on talking about something different, his investigation into toxic household chemicals and fire flame retardants. But he did a story about a week ago about lead levels in Chicago, and what he found was that in small pockets of the city, very poor areas, the rates of lead poisoning were still much higher than we should be comfortable with. And one of the reasons why is that much of the funding for lead poisoning prevention had been cut, the inspectors had been cut. And I know from talking to people over the years at the Maryland Department of the Environment that even one case of lead poisoning is too many because it's so easily preventable, and that when such incidences occur, it's so destructive that it can really ruin your life. So I wanted to know from you, what are you doing about this problem? I know the law was recently changed houses built before 19, it was everything before 1950, but now it's everything before 1978 too.
Right,
so
right.
If you could talk a little bit about that. And
Preventing lead poisoning is a priority. MDE has a very strong program. We're beefing it up. We're going to have more staff involved, more inspectors. It's really important to work with other departments like health and mental hygiene on lead testing, blood lead levels of kids age 1 and 2. We have a pretty good infrastructure in place to do work, but we haven't done enough yet. I mean, we have reduced from 98% by 98% the number of kids with high lead levels, but that requires more testing and more work, registration and certification with rental units with the landlords.
What was the change in the law that
this is a really big deal, and it's all a move in the right direction. Basically, what the legislature agreed to do was to reach back even farther to commercial rental properties prior to 1978, all the way back to 1950. So that universe of rental properties have to, by law, they have to register with the Maryland Department of the Environment. They have to get an inspector to then be able to certify that the paint in the apartment is not flaking, chipping, or going to create, you know, become part of the dust. They become part of our database. There are also requirements that are triggered by that in terms of young children being tested for their blood lead levels. It also leads to the requirement, if you have high levels of lead, to get those to get it remediated and to be fixed. So we see if kids are not every kid should be able to grow up in a safe and healthy watershed and a safe and healthy community, and terrible things happen when they're deprived of that. And so lead, the dangerous neurotoxin that it is, needs continued attention, and we're absolutely focused on it.
So what the law did was it expanded the universe of properties that were covered. So properties from between 1950 and 1978 are now covered. Yes.
I had a question about what was a controversial topic before you came into your position, Governor Hogan vowing to, I don't know if repeal is the word, or do away with or change in some way the phosphorus management tools put in place by the O'Malley administration, at the end of O'Malley administration, controversy about, how much you're going to require poultry farmers to do here in terms of remediating phosphorus runoff. And it, long and the short of it to me was that the governor put in place rules that looked pretty much like what the O'Malley administration had put in place, with a few differences, not too much.
Well, I think it's a great story of success and collaboration when you have new opportunities that are created. And I'm not pointing the finger at anybody in the previous administration. It was a very combative. There was a lack of trust between agriculture and the environmental community. What happened was that there was a new direction, and that direction was, we absolutely want this new tool on managing phosphorus. Everybody knows it's a problem. Oversaturated fields, are 308 million chickens on the Eastern Shore.
Yes.
You've got to manage them. So they went into overdrive, and over time, the Maryland Department of Agriculture, working with others to improve upon the substitute proposed regulations, found a workable compromise that moves the ball forward, the environmental ball. And, I think it's a good story of collaboration, adopting a new scientific tool and agreeing to work together. And I think there was some leadership involved among a lot of people. There are legislators, certainly Governor Hogan, who didn't want to roll back the environmental clock. He just wanted to get a new tool out there that represented his administration's involvement.
Okay, but am I correct, Rona? What do you think in looking at that? There isn't much of a difference between the two. Between what O'Malley put forward and Governor Hogan's administration put forward?
There isn't much of a difference. And in fact, in some ways, the Hogan proposal is stronger because it does take the highest saturation fields right away and says, okay, you can put no more on. And I've said before on the show that I think it was monumental that we get this passed.
Yeah.
And I think that the governor is to be congratulated for getting it done, especially when he had indicated earlier that he would not do it. But, the one thing that... that is always the devil is the details. And there have been a lot of people who have expressed concern that the Maryland Department of Agriculture will be enforcing the PMT, and they would rather see your department enforce the PMT because the Maryland Department of Agriculture's role is to advocate for farmers. So you have the advocators also being the enforcers. So I'd like to know, are you going to have any more inspectors? Are you going to be sort of taking this over more as an enforcement role?
Yeah, we're absolutely going to be involved in it. We want it to be a success. And so, and the governor has directed me and the team at MDE to be involved. And we have a great working relationship. And Dan, I think if people are saying there's not much difference between the two, then I think both administrations should take credit for it. I think there was, you know, it's a good example of collaboration over confrontation.
I have another question following up on our earlier discussion about stormwater remediation, and I'm thanking Stephanie, one of our listeners, for writing in with this question, because I spoke to a man who paved a long driveway on his property not very far from what used to be a trout stream, could be a trout stream again someday, a spring-fed area that, you know, with a little work, probably could have brook trout in it again someday. And he just didn't see what I was... I tried to explain to him that the heat in the summertime generated by mm-hmm. All that asphalt and rain coming down, washing off it, going not so much into the ground next to it, but eventually right into that stream, not far by a stream, is more like a lick or a run. Anyway, a brook would continue to diminish it. It's the water quality in there for in the hope of ever having, say, trout in it again one day. She wonders, Stephanie wonders, how to get rid of a long blacktop driveway, all of which I don't want or need. It was there when she moved in Cub Hill. Is there any program or help for homeowners who want to get rid of all these impervious surfaces on their property?
So, first of all, thank you for your public service and working with neighbors and citizens to help boost environmental stewardship.
At least have the discussion, you mean?
Yeah.
Didn't
well,
get very
right.
far, but...
things take time. So one of the priorities for Maryland Department of the Environment is work with the counties and the local jurisdictions on managing stormwater. We have stormwater permits that are controversial at times because they involve major investments, and they are the enforceable regulatory driver for managing these flows that can pollute local streams in the bay. In our permits, we have a very bold goal, an enforceable requirement that tells the county, which has jurisdiction over the citizens and how they use their land, that they have to restore during that term of that five-year permit term 20% of the impervious surface area within that watershed. It's controversial. It depends on how you count the numbers. It's a noble goal. It's one we're committed to, and we know there needs to be flexibility and local creativity in how to do that. But so counties are developing different types of programs, funding, technical assistance, education, to work with property owners, businesses, large institutions that have a lot of land to green their watersheds and to make choices on retrofitting.
So Stephanie, in Cub Hill in Baltimore County, should identify that person in county government who's in charge of this and ask that question.
Right.
Can I get a tax credit of some kind if I spend some money chopping up this asphalt and putting down a pervious surface?
Right.
Thank you for being here today, Ben Grumbles.
My pleasure.
Please come back and visit us again.
I will.
Ben Grumbles is the new Maryland Environmental Secretary, been on the job since March, joining us here for Midday on the Bay with Rona Cabell. Rona Cabell, you can read her stories, the one she's referenced at Chesapeake Bay Journal. No,
BayJournal.com. BayJournal.com,
yeah,
yes.
Right. And congratulations again on your award, Rona.
Oh, thank you so much.
Rona will join us again in another month for another edition of Midday on the Bay. Today's lunch for our guests, provided by Eddie's of Roland Park, offering gourmet sandwiches, soups, salads, and desserts at its two stores on Roland Avenue and one on North Charles Street. Personal shopping, catering, and gift baskets are available at Eddie'sofRolandPark.com. Thanks for tuning in, everyone. See you again for Midday Friday.
Midday's producer is Maureen Harvey. The associate producers are Michael Himowitz, Melody Simmons, and Connor Graham. Our interns are Aaron Morenzi, Alexis Kuhn, and Aaliyah Satterfield. Midday's engineer is Luke Spicknell. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming is available at WYPR.org. Dan Roderick's column appears in the Baltimore Sun. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.